The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
All right, we're going to be dealing with chapter 2 of John today. And I have entitled this lecture, or whatever, Cana in Jerusalem. Not just for the obvious reason that we're dealing with two events taking place in these two cities, but because, as I tried to point out when we were talking about the outline or the structure of the book, that the geographical locations of this sort seem to play a significant role in the actual composition of the gospel. And without looking for any esoteric meanings to the use of these city names, I think they do provide something of a clue for the way the material, the narrative is developed, and so on. Now, let's say a few things of an introductory character about the structure of not just chapter 2 right now, but I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the structure of a whole section, because most scholars, I think this is correct, most scholars recognize that chapters 2 through 4 belong together, and that the broad theme of newness, the theological conception of the new thing that Jesus brings in, seems to provide a unifying thread to the whole section. There are a couple of details, however, which I think I touched on very briefly when we were going over my outline. There are a couple of points which are less clear in terms of where to actually see the demarcations of the paragraphs. For example, is it certain that the section that I am focusing on right now really begins with the story of the wedding in Cana, chapter 2, verses 1 to 11. Is that the real beginning of the section? If you reflect on the connection between the end of chapter 1 and this incident, it appears, or at least a possible way of looking at it, is to view the story of the wedding in Cana as the culmination of what you might call the disciple narrative. Now, we normally don't think of it in those terms, partly because of the chapter division, and partly because the story does not seem directly to be concerned with the disciples. But when you get to the end of the story and the point is made that the disciples saw his glory and they believed, then it becomes immediately clear there is a very direct connection between the two. And you could see verse 11 as the climax of that narrative. You have had a developing story with regard to the disciples of John the Baptist coming to Jesus, and chapter 2, verse 11 provides the end point of that. If so, then you might argue that instead of looking at verses at chapter 1, verses 19 to 51, the way that I have done in my outline as an introduction, you might argue that really verse 19 of chapter 1 begins the body of the gospel proper. And then that whole passage is an integral part of the section that ends in chapter 4. Now, I'm not persuaded that's the best way of looking at it, but even just thinking about this possibility is helpful in stressing and highlighting the continuity of the narrative between chapters 1 and 2, and that, I think, has to be taken seriously. Now, the second issue, and one that perhaps is a more serious one, is whether the end, and I'm talking here about the miracle story in chapter 4, verses 43 to 54, whether that last pericope belongs in the section. Now, one of the arguments in favor of bringing it, of including it in part of, as part of that section, and indeed the last event or the last paragraph of that section, is that if you do so, then you have the possibility of looking at the structure in terms of an inclusio. Remember the term. Now, why people have to use the Latin inclusio and instead of just adding the end at the end beats me. But, you know, well, it doesn't beat me. It's part of the bluffing act. You know, you want to sound a little bit more. The point would be that if indeed you include chapter 4, 43 to 54, as the end of the section, then what you have in this whole section is that a miracle in Cana both opens and closes the section. So that literary technique of inclusion. And that way of looking at the material would be reinforced by the strong parallelism between the end of the first miracle and the end of that second miracle. You recall that in chapter 2, verse 11, we're told, tautain e poies in archeinton semeion ho Jesus. This first of signs, Jesus did in Cana of Galilee. That's chapter 2, verse 11. Then you go to chapter 4, verse 54, and you're told, tuta de palin deuteron semeion. This second sign Jesus did or performed when he came out of Judea into Galilee. Now that cannot be accidental. I mean, it's very obviously intended as a parallel. And you could argue that that specific statement reinforces the notion that the that other miracle in Cana is intended as sort of tying things together or bringing a whole section to its conclusion. And that's why in my outline I put it the way I did. However, I have to acknowledge that you can make a pretty interesting argument for the view that that passage at the end of chapter 4 is really the beginning of a new section. And the arguments would be, number one, that incident, the healing of the servant, has no apparent reference to the theme of newness, which I was arguing before was the unifying theme in the section. In fact, and I guess this would be a second argument, the theme that is highlighted in that passage is the theme of life, which seems to anticipate one of the major concerns of chapter 5 and then the subsequent material as well. What I'm talking about is that if you look carefully at the language used there in chapter 4, for instance, in verse 50, after after the man says, Jesus, go down before my child dies, my servant dies. Then verse 50, Jesus says to him, go, ho huiosu ze, your son lives. The language is repeated in verse 51. The servants met him saying, ho pais autou ze, that his servant lived, he lives. And then again in verse 53, therefore the father knew in that hour in which Jesus said to them, ho huiosu ze, your son lives. So there is a clearly deliberate repetition of this language, your son lives, three times. And then when you move into chapter 5, the concept of life and Christ as the giver of life becomes the predominant motif. If I remember correctly, Dodd argues along these lines. I have to double check that. But in any case, that's an important argument, or really a twofold argument. It has nothing to say about newness. It has a lot to say about life. I would want to argue without, you know, this is not the sort of thing you ought to make a big deal about. You know, okay, so divide it one way, divide it the other, it's no big problem. In either case, it becomes apparent that this passage serves as a transitional paragraph. And maybe that's the best way of looking at it, I don't know. But I guess I would respond to the argument that it anticipates the theme of life, that when you get to chapter 5, that theme of life is also played against the way in which the Jews react to Jesus, and the theme of Jewish opposition, which is just as prominent, if not more so, is not present in this miracle in Cana. One other argument for seeing this passage as not belonging to the section chapters 2 through 4 is that if you leave it out, and I do recall that Dodd argues along these lines, Dodd says that then you could see a rather neat arrangement of two events in chapter 2 and then two discourses, 1 in 3 and 1 in 4. Maybe so, but I'm not quite so confident. And of course, I think I have heard or read somewhere that even if you leave out the that second miracle, you could still have your structural break at chapter 4, verse 46. Then Jesus came again to Cana of Galilee, where he had made the water wine. Maybe that would be the break, and there you would have the inclusion by having the reference to Cana, and now begins a new section. That's a possibility as well. Well, again, I don't think one ought to feel some great burden to come to a final decision about this sort of thing, just as long as you appreciate where some of the connections are, and then you try to avoid reading the chapter in isolation from any part of the context that may shed some light on what John is trying to do here. Question, yeah?
The Seleucus, is he a Gentile official?
Yeah, I think so.
That would be new.
Oh, that's a good point. Sure. Yeah, because there's no reference to Gentiles at all before. You do have the Samaritan. All right. I'll put it down. Try to remember to give you a footnote here. Any other wisdom? Yeah.
Suppose to approve that passage as a transition, which shares a characteristic of one section.
Sure. Yeah, I think it, and it, whatever you say about it, ultimately, I think you have to acknowledge that that is at least part of what the passage is doing, bringing something that has been already mentioned to conclusion in some respects, but also preparing you for what's coming next. Yeah. All right, let's move on then to deal with the story of the wedding feast in Cana. This is the great passage for Christian liberty. It's okay to, you know. And of course, and of course, we all know that that's exactly what John was intending to do by telling us about this. This pericope is really rich with themes that show up for the first time, or at least almost the first time in the case of a few of them. And what I want to do is simply to list them and say a little bit about them and try to get a sense of how this passage brings together very, very important topics that either constitute really fundamental themes within the gospel as a whole, or that anticipate later developments as you continue the narrative. So first of all, the obvious one, you have a wedding, the theme of the wedding. Now this one, it does not become a prominent theme in the rest of the gospel, but it has obviously a symbolic function. You remember that in the synoptics, Jesus uses the figure of the wedding at various points in a couple of the parables in Matthew 22 and Matthew 25. Then you have the passage in in Luke chapter 12. Luke 12, 36. We'll begin with verse 35. Be dressed ready for service and keep your lamps burning, like men waiting for their master to return from a wedding banquet. And it is, in a way, peculiar that the point should be made that it is a wedding banquet. I mean, you could have said anything, any kind of banquet or any kind of feast, but specifically a wedding banquet. And then again in Mark chapter 2, verse 19, better known passage. And when you take into account not only that Jesus had used the theme of the wedding at various points in his ministry, but that you have a broader canonical theme, and I'm talking about on the one hand Isaiah, for example, Isaiah chapter 54. Beginning with verse 4, do not be afraid. You will not suffer shame. Do not fear disgrace. You will not be humiliated. You will forget the shame of your youth and remember no more the reproach of your widowhood. For your Maker is your husband. The Lord Almighty is his name. The Holy One of Israel is your Redeemer. He is called the God of all the earth. The Lord will call you back as if you were a wife deserted and distressed in spirit, a wife who married young only to be rejected, says your God. And then develops the notion of God's compassion in the setting, again, using the figure of the wedding as a reflection of God's mercy toward Israel. Then again in chapter 62, verses 4 and 5, no longer will they call you deserted or name your land desolate, but you will be called Hephzibah and your land Beulah, for the Lord will take delight in you, and your land will be married.
For a theological seminary in Philadelphia,
maiden, so will your sons
for a complete
marry
brochure
you,
of Westminster Media products and services, write to the
address over you. Now, when you take the theme of the wedding feast as a way of describing God's gracious salvation toward his people, the sayings of Jesus in the Gospels, and then most climactically and dramatically, Revelation 19, as part of the Johannine tradition in some sense. It's very difficult to read this passage in John chapter 2 and not assume that the reference to the wedding, John's choice of including this passage, it's difficult to assume that that choice has no symbolic associations. There must be a particular reason for that. I might also, point out that when you get to chapter 4, verse 43, we're told, and after 2 days, he went out from there into Galilee. After 2 days, that sounds like a third day. So again, John seems to be getting us to think in such terms, just before he introduces that other story in Galilee, in Cana of Galilee. There's the further question that, again, I very briefly mentioned last time, whether there's any significance in the total of 6 days. There are 4 days mentioned in chapter 1, and then the third day would be like the day after tomorrow. So that sounds like 6. Carson argues that the total is really 7, and technically that is probably true. But I guess I have to wonder whether if you have certain explicit markers, you know, the next day, the next day, the next day, then on the third day, whether those explicit markers shouldn't have greater weight. Shouldn't we give greater weight to that than to expect that a reader would sit down and figure out the total accurately, taking into account all the little variations of the proper way of referring to days and so on. In other words, the what shall we call the naive reader? That's I don't want that, but you know,
casual.
The casual? No, not casual.
Uninformed.
No. Just a plain reader, you know, who isn't looking for all kinds of details and trying to figure everything out in terms of some mysterious pattern. Just from reading, I think we see, you know, next day, next day, next day, and then the third day, 6 days probably. But who cares? I don't know. What is more significant is that all of this is followed by reference to the Passover, which parallels what happens in chapter 12, verse 1. Ho un Jesus pro hex hemeron tu Pascha. 6 days before the Passover, he came to Bethany. So if indeed it is a six-day period that John is trying to bring out to the reader, then it anticipates the 6 days followed by Passover that is going to come up in chapter 12. And so again, you have an anticipation of Jesus' passion, which you would not pick up on the first reading. But as we'll see, there are other clues that anybody would pick up after more than one reading. All right, a third point, a third issue, is what we might call the matter of proper timing, proper timing. You know what I'm referring to here, that after Mary asked Jesus to help out, we read in verse 4, Jesus says to her, then you have this interesting idiom, tia moi kai soi, what to me and to you, which, you know, different people translate different ways, but sounds just a little bit, you know, like he's putting putting her off a bit. And then the reason given is, upo heke hehoramu, my hour has not come. It is not the right moment. It is not the proper timing for me to do this.
What
chapter, sir? 2:4. Some people refer to this as Jesus' vacillating negativeness. Jesus' vacillating negativeness, which shows up not only in this passage, but also in chapter 4, interestingly. You remember how after the man asked Jesus to heal his son, we're told in verse 48, Jesus therefore said to him, unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. So Jesus appears to be unwilling to respond to the request, but eventually he does it. At first he appears unwilling to respond to Mary's request, but he does it. And there are other examples of this. Remember in chapter 7, verse 1, where Jesus' brothers tell, well, we're going up to the feast, coming along, and Jesus says, no, you go ahead. And yet he does it anyway. Or in chapter 11, where the news comes to Jesus that Lazarus has died, and he appears to, you know, be unconcerned about it, but then eventually he goes. That is a clear pattern in the gospel. There's an article that was written by a fellow named Giblin, C.H. Giblin, or Giblin, I'm not sure. And I don't have the title here, but it appeared in New Testament Studies, volume 26 for 1978 and 79, pages 197 to 211. In Giblin's approach, he tries to make an argument for the view that John is establishing a pattern for Jesus' behavior. And the point is that Jesus is concerned to act not according to the human situation, but in his own terms. And when you reflect about that for a while, and you think of it in terms of the teaching of the gospel as a whole, oh yeah, this really fits, you know, what part of what the gospel is trying to get across. You know that it is in the Gospel of John where you have that expression of Jesus, I lay my life down. I am the one who lays it down. You know, nobody takes it from me. This is my own decision. I do it. And John definitely is seeking to portray Jesus in the gospel as someone who, when he acts not because it is, you know, it is, there's some pressure upon him because of the human situation, but he is acting according to his own terms, and he makes a decision when and how and where to act. There was a lot of discussion going on because at that time there was already a requirement that not only the faculty but the students were not allowed to partake of alcoholic beverages at all, not just on campus or, you know, just not at all, ever, anywhere. And finally they achieved some sort of compromise. The year that I came was also the first year for a rather young president, a really suave, charming fellow named Lyle Hilligus, who persuaded everybody to come up with this compromise where people were not supposed to do this on campus or its environments, I think was the way it was phrased. And of course, all right, what is the environment? You know, how far do you have to go? And Lyle Hilligus, you know, somewhat casually must say, well, I don't know, maybe a mile or something. The next day, as I was driving up Sycamore Canyon Road, there was this white line on the road, professionally done. I mean, that really looked like like the transit authorities or whatever had done this. And there was another one from the other side of the road, and another one, the three ways going to the campus. And there was the line, and I was affectionately referred to as Lyle's Mile from that point on. Anyway, the point is that the wine is already linked with the concept of the wedding in Mark chapter 2, and it's parallel in Luke 5. The theme of wine comes up in the Gospel of John again in chapter 6, and then again in chapter 15 in connection with the allegory of the vine. Now, I might parenthetically here remind you of, if you did the reading in Dodd, you came across this, but in his book on the interpretation of the fourth gospel, page 298, where Dodd provides what I think is a rather interesting comment regarding the distinction between author's meaning and audience meaning. And this is the way he puts it. Already in early Christian art, the scene of the miracle of Cana often forms a counterpart to that of the multiplication of the loaves. So in you know, various kinds of paintings in early church history, there will be a combining of these two scenes, the wedding of Cana and the multiplication of the loaves, in allusion to the bread and wine of the Eucharist. And it may well be that even for the earliest Christian readers of John 2, the Eucharistic complex of ideas was in mind and was intended to be in mind, he says, perhaps. Yet no explicit allusion is made, and the non-Christian reader would have no inkling of it. In all this, we may find valid indications of the context of thought and imagination within which the present passage may have shaped itself in the writer's mind. But it does not supply a plain clue which the contemporary reader might be expected to seize. Let me reread that again. When you look at these various details, which are a little bit subtle, in all this we may find valid indications of the context of thought and imagination within which the present passage may have shaped itself in the writer's mind. In other words, Dodd is allowing for the possibility that the bread and wine of the Lord's Supper may have in some way contributed to the shaping of the passage or the composition of the narrative or something. Nevertheless, the information we have, that is the actual features of the text, do not supply a plain clue which the contemporary reader might be expected to seize. Now, I said I wanted to mention this parenthetically because it is an interesting issue that comes up, often it comes up subconsciously when people are talking about the meaning of passages and how you apply them and so on. And at least to my way of thinking, something which a contemporary reader could not be expected to seize, in my way of thinking, that is an indication that it probably ought not to play a very significant part of the exegesis. Now, let me give you a wild example of a wild parallel. A long time ago, I heard a rather famous a musicologist give some lectures on Bach, and particularly on the Matthew Passion. And he was giving us all this information about Bach's life and his students, and how Bach liked to include little things in his music which nobody really understood except his own disciples, who knew he was adding things here for his own pleasure or fun or whatever. And he mentioned in particular, I haven't checked this out, so you have to take my, and I cannot even give you the actual figures because I've forgotten them, if I ever learned them. But he says that when in the Matthew Passion, in connection with the earthquake in Jesus' resurrection, there are all these passages where the organ is playing lots of, you know, notes. And he says, if you look at it carefully, you find that all of those notes can be divided into three sets. The first set is, 35 notes, and the second set, 70 notes, and the third set, 100 notes. And then what do? You go to Psalms 37 or whatever I said, and 70, and they're the only Psalms where the word earthquake is found in the Psalms. Now, I haven't double-checked it, but he was a very eminent musicologist, and I don't think he would have, given us a whopper there, but if all this is true, I mean, who in the world listening to the Matthew Passion would be expected first to be counting notes as the organ is playing it, playing them, and then remember, oh, of course, earthquake appears in Psalm this and so on. But you see the problem that you have there. If all this is true, then it is obviously in the part of the intention, if you will, of the author of Bach. Does it play a role in your exegesis of the music? Well, you don't need it. Those low bass notes already indicate the earthquake, the rumbling. That's where the quote meaning is. And you don't have to know some of these subtleties to be able to appreciate what the music is trying to do. Now, in the case of literature, it's a little bit different. But here's where, if you have certain subtleties, and in this case, there are subtleties that cannot be confirmed in the same way, you might be willing to acknowledge, perhaps these played a part in the composition of the narrative. But if it is not something that could be reasonably expected for a reader to pick up, then it's probably not a good idea to make too much of it reconstituting of the meaning of the text. Question? Yeah.
Well, I think maybe for instance, we know that Bach would take his name and put that into his music, and I think acknowledging that he would never let that destroy the musicality
right.
of the music. In other words, he would do those little tricks all the time, mm-hmm. but he would never lose sight of the fact that this is a piece of music. It's not a piece of, it's not a puzzle for himself.
Right.
I think in a similar way, maybe the book author might have some illusions, but it wouldn't destroy his overall purpose.
Mm-hmm. One of the reasons I found that particularly interesting is that I heard that lecture even in the Bob Gundry was producing his work on Matthew, and if you've ever taken a look at that commentary, he really pushes some very, very subtle connections and pushes them rather hard in terms of, well, this appears to be Matthianism, and then you link it up with this, and then Matthew seems to be doing this and doing that. And I was very, very skeptical of some of these things. And then I hear this lecture, and I say, well, maybe Matthew had a little game going too, you know, who knows. But if those kinds of details are going to distract you from what appears to be the main thrust of the passage, it's probably not a good idea. Yeah, I think we all have to recognize that if you take seriously the notion of a divine author, then obviously what comes within the purview of the divine author cannot be restricted to what any one individual author's knowledge or perception might have been. And that, and furthermore, what comes within the purview of the divine author is not even limited to what we find in Scripture.
Right.
It goes even beyond that, so that, you know, from time to time we come across some sort of problem, and now we go to a passage of Scripture, and obviously the author couldn't have possibly anticipated that problem because it's maybe a little bit distinctive to certain cultural difference or whatever. You know, in purely human terms, you might say, well, what a coincidence that what John said back there has a real value or contribution to make to a completely different circumstance. But if the divine author behind it is truly an omniscient author, then it's no coincidence. There are other things going on there.
Yeah, what tension do you have that with the contemporary reader, somebody in John, say, who's reading that? I guess that's what I'm missing. In other words...
Well, it just depends what kind of question you're asking. I mean, normally when we're talking about, you know, historical, grammatical exegesis, you're making a very self-conscious effort to identify authorial meaning within its own historical setting. There are other factors involved in our whole conception of what the faith is in Revelation, what God may do with His Word, and so on. But I think it remains valid to say there's a particular job that needs to be done responsibly and well. There may be other questions that are also valid, but the one that I was asking before was along these lines, and a different kind of tension, one where you might suspect that indeed this was part of what the author was thinking, but if you cannot, and if the author could not have expected his readers to pick up on that, I'm saying we better not make too much of it. Well, still within the context of this issue of the wine, of what appears to be the real point is, as you know, the abundance of the miracle that Jesus performs. You know, these containers, that was a lot of wine. I mean, far more wine than could have been used in any wedding like that. And there appears to be some hyperbole involved in it. And the hyperbole of such, clearly, I think, is intended to evoke some of the material from the Old Testament. You remember in Amos chapter 9, that remarkable promise where out of the blue, because you know that the whole book of Amos, you know, is so negative, indicting the people and telling them how bad they are and this and that. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, for no apparent reason, you have this incredible promise at the end of chapter 9, I will restore David's fallen tent and so on. And then verse 13, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when the reaper will be overtaken by the plowman and the planter by the one treading grapes. There's so much, you know, the harvest and everything else is so full, and then so much of it is going on that the people who are reaping just cannot do it fast enough for the ones who are behind them with the next, you know, whatever. I'm not a farmer. New wine will drip from the mountains and flow from all the hills. New wine will drip from the mountains and flow from all the hills, and so on. You have some other passages in Hosea, chapter 14, verse 7. Man will dwell again in his shade. He will flourish like the grain. He will blossom like a vine, and his fame will be like the wine from Lebanon. Or Jeremiah 31, verse 12. They will come and shout for joy in the heights of Zion. They will rejoice in the bounty of the Lord, the grain, the new wine, and the oil, the young of the flocks and herds. They will be like a well-watered garden. They will sorrow no more. So the notion of a wine, new wine, or abundance of wine already associated with eschatological blessing, the fullness of what God has been promising for His people. A fifth theme is that of water. Now, water already shows up in chapter 1 in connection with the baptism. Then you have it here. Then again, in chapter 3, being born of water and the Spirit. We'll talk about that next time. Not next time. Next time is your test, right? Chapter 4, the well, Jacob's well in Samaria. Chapter 5, the water, which is troubled and the lame man is unable to reach it. Chapter 7, the Feast of Dedication. Chapter 9, in this case, the spittle to heal the blind man. And then finally in chapter 19, blood and water coming out of Jesus' side. Obviously something is going on here. In this case, in chapter 2, and possibly also in chapter 5 with the lame man, the water, this is a quotation from Bultmann, by the way, water stands for everything that is a substitute for the revelation, everything by which man thinks he can live and which yet fails him when put to the test. I think there is something to that. Now, there's more to it than that. The next item, number 6 here, would be that of Jewishness. And perhaps these two things need to be put together. Water can have more than one symbolic referent. And in this particular context, it is possible that the water is associated with Judaism. I mean, there is the explicit reference to the Jewish practices in verse 6, chapter 2, verse 6. There were the six containers and so on. Kataton katharismanton yudaion kemenai, according to the cleansing rituals of the Jews. So John appears to want us to link the water to Jewish cleansing rituals. And this is where part of the theme of newness comes up. John is telling us something is going to transcend the ability or the powers of Judaism. Now, the 7th, 8th, and 9th themes are respectively signs, glory, and faith. Signs, glory, and faith. And they all show up, of course, in the concluding verse, verse 11. This is the first sign, etc. Kai phanerosen ten doxen autou, and he revealed his glory. Kai pistousan eis auton hoi mathetartou, and his disciples believed in him. These three things are brought together. And so it isn't just the significance of each of these themes individually, but here you have the primary focus of the passage. Now, we wait until verse 11 to get a sense for this. The first 10 verses, it just sounds like an interesting story, a remarkable story, and what a miracle, and all that. But the real point of it is this combination, this complex of ideas in verse 11. There's a sign that Jesus performs, and by the way, in this verse, it is perfectly plain that you cannot think of signs purely negative terms. There are some passages in John that seem to have that negative nuance. You Jews are asking for signs. I'm not going to give you signs, you know, have a similar thing in the synoptics. But there are other passages in John of a different character. And so within the proper setting, signs become not an obstacle, but in effect, they contribute to faith. And it would be quite misleading to think of the Gospel of John as being driven by an attempt to downplay the significance of signs. In some settings, in certain contexts, it is important to make that point, but that's not the whole story. And so within the context of faith, the signs play a very positive role. The theme of glory is one that, again, we're going to have to wait until the end of the semester to focus on, but just to mention what is obvious, in the prologue, you do have that climactic statement, we have seen his glory, we saw his glory as of the only begotten of the Father. And this is the first time in the narrative where you have an explicit reference to the glory. Now, we noticed at the end of chapter 1 that there seems to be some kind of allusion to the manifestation of God's presence and his glory in the case of Jesus, but that's more indirect, a little bit more subtle. Here you have the explicit use of the term doxa, and again, the voluntary act of Jesus, he manifested his glory. He let people see it. And so we're supposed to understand the miracle in Cana as one way in which Jesus manifests his glory, and that which led his disciples. This is the first time that we're told in so many words, and they believed in him. And they believed in him. And now that is going to become kind of a measuring rod, if you will, for the subsequent material. We'll see how this is played out at the end of chapter 2, the next hour. Well, any questions on the wedding story of Cana? Yeah. Yeah, undoubtedly. And now, what's the expression you used? Stretching the truth. Now, what about this matter of Bethany over against Bethania? Is a variant spelling, if this is what we have here, a stretching of the truth? I'm not asking you to answer that question, but obviously there is the another slide of issues where you can begin to say, well, can you buy this much? Oh, yeah. How about this much? Well, maybe. And how about this much? And now I don't know about that. And every one of us has a different, resistance level or whatever. I think it makes a big difference how we're coming at the material. I mean, if you've read five books that are very historically oriented, footnoted, quotation marks, ellipses to mark where the quotation is not, and you go to all these troubles to be absolutely responsible in the detail. And then you come to the Gospel of John against the background of that, then you find some, your own inner resistance to say, well, is he modifying anything to make it a more theological, whatever. But if you've just read five very powerful either historical novels or dramatized kinds of things where the issue of truth really doesn't quite come up because everybody acknowledges that while there is that basic element of truth, the author is trying to, I have never heard people arguing whether a particular play by Shakespeare, now this is not historically true, that's not the way that Richard III really, it's, well, different genre, business, if you come at the Gospel of John having reflected on that, then you would probably draw the line a little differently. And our difficulty, naturally, is that we don't have John to interview and see exactly what his perspective on all that was. But I am not, if what you were suggesting is maybe we need to downplay these apparent theological meanings because it might lead other people to say this is not historical. No, I mean, if it appears to be in the text, I'm not sure whether I caught the drift of your question. You're talking about historical, that it is historically factual? That the detail indicates that he's concerned with being historically factual? Sure, absolutely, I would say so.